Eating with the Enemy, How I Waged Peace with North Korea from My Barbecue Shack in Hackensack, is a story about how an ordinary citizen of the United States accomplished things that the State Department can only dream of. Bobby Egan forged relationships with diplomats from Vietnam and North Korea and did his best to improve relations between our countries. Along the way, he's had some pretty incredible experiences, and that's what we're going to hear about during the next 54 minutes or so. Joining me this hour are the co-authors of Eating with the Enemy, Robert Bobby Egan, owner of Cubby's, a barbecue restaurant in Hackensack, New Jersey. Good morning, Bobby, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
And also joining me is Kurt Pitzer, journalist, author, and commercial longline fisherman and co-author of Eating with the Enemy. Good morning to you, Kurt, and thanks for joining us.
Morning, John. Thanks for having us.
Bobby Egan, we'll start with you. How did a guy from New Jersey end up getting involved in international diplomacy?
Well, I guess it all started with that trip to the UN when I was in high school. A light bulb went off, and I kind of, my interest, there's a whole other world outside the United States. Well, certainly that trip gave me the enlightenment that there's so many different other cultures besides your own. And it just took a big interest to it. I started preparing myself for the Vietnam War at a young age. I wasn't the type, I was on the wrong side of the tracks growing up. I was a blue-collar kid. I didn't have any funding to go to college, nor did I have the skills. At the time, I was pretty much a goof-off in high school, knowing that I was going to be an industrial roofing contractor when I came back from the war. That was my ticket to make a living. My father was a roofing contractor. But I got a keen interest in the world, and then, particularly in Asia, by going to the UN and then preparing myself to go fight the Vietnamese. The war ended before I got out of high school, so I didn't have to go. But the interest remained with me, and it developed when I started getting interested in the POW-MIA movement, knowing that we had left men behind.
So how did you act on that? You had that concern that was on your mind. How did you put those words into action?
I made a phone call to the UN. I knew that they had a mission that represented their they had a UN mission that was their representation to the United Nations, even enemy states that we don't have diplomatic relations with, such as North Korea and at the time Vietnam. They are entitled to have missions to the United Nations in New York. I made a phone call, got their telephone number, made a phone call. We had some conversations over the next couple months, had an opportunity to meet them, befriended them, and we were off and running from there. And Vietnam was my ticket. The Vietnamese mission here was open to me. It was just a few years after the end of the war. So certainly it wasn't fashionable to be seen with Vietnamese officials in New York. They're half a world away from their family, their government. There's 22 members over here. So there wasn't a whole long line of people looking to be their friends. So I befriended them. I took advantage of that. Developed a keen relationship with them, an interesting relationship. Through that relationship, I went over to Hanoi, and I developed a relationship with the central government, the central communist government in Vietnam. And developed relations over there, and back and forth they would send delegations from Hanoi to the UN to be represented, at the UN General Assembly, other negotiation sessions with the for humanitarian aid, monetary fund workshops here at the UN. So I got to meet a lot of different delegations through that small mission at the UN. And that was the key to me developing relations with these enemy states, was their representatives here at the United Nations.
Mm-hmm. When I first started looking at this book, and actually when I first heard about it, I thought it sounded more like a movie plot than a true story. Kurt Pitzer, how did you come upon this story? Where did you come in on this?
Well, Bobby and I met. There had been some news coverage of Bobby's story, and we met, and he started playing me some tapes that he'd been recording that were basically from his restaurant. He was sort of was afraid of getting in trouble for sticking his nose where it didn't belong. And they were an incredible series of recordings of him calling the North Korean mission to the United Nations, of him calling Ross Perot and trying to drum up some freelance POW efforts, calling the National Security Council colonels who were trying to shut him down, and his FBI contacts, and in between them, fielding orders from his barbecue restaurant. And I thought, this is a story unlike any other here of an ordinary guy who has seen something he doesn't like in the world, U.S. relations or non-relations with its enemies, and decided to do something about it. And I thought it was a great story to write. I mean, you don't get a chance to write this kind of story very often.
Well, let me be clear, too. Those recordings were done over a short period of time. I was involved. This is the recordings were taken when I was involved in an international crisis when North Korea had landed a submarine on South Korean shores. And a lot of people got killed, North and South Korean. And I was directly involved in the negotiations for North Korea to come forward with an apology to South Korea. And I wasn't taking the direction of the National Security Council too well, because what I did was I had the North Koreans put up Americans that they still had in prison in North Korea in lieu of apologizing to South Korea. The National Security Council didn't want that. So I was warned that because I was going against U.S. policy and that I was directly involved in these negotiations, I was the White House's conduit at the time to North Korea. And because I was going against that policy and I was detrimental to it, I was advising the North Koreans not to take the deal, not to apologize. In lieu of that, give us those men back, and you don't have to apologize to South Korea. You don't have to lose face. Well, then it was suggested to me by a gentleman in the Department of Defense that I record, during that particular crisis, record my conversations with the FBI, the South Koreans, the North Koreans. Because violating the Logan Act. So that's the only reason I recorded those conversations.
Yeah, well, hang on, because I want to back up a second here first. Bob, you, at the beginning, we started talking about how you got involved with the Vietnamese government. How did you first get involved with the North Koreans?
What happened was, towards the end of my relationship with Vietnam, it was the 1992 Senate Select Committee. What I did is I had a pretty middle-ranking Vietnamese official defect and testify at those committee hearings that there was a secret prison in Vietnam. And, in fact, it was common knowledge that live Americans at the end of the war were still being held captive in Vietnam. He openly testified with myself at the Senate Select Committee. That ended my relationship with Vietnam. We still had his children back in Hanoi, so I had to make a deal to get his kids back. Part of the condition was that him and I keep quiet, that we don't disclose any more secrets. It was understood that what we had to say about the POW issue, okay, was already said, damage done, ended there, and eventually Vietnam made an agreement after so many years would send Kai's children back, which they held up to. They did. Vietnam was contacted, from what I understand, by the North Koreans, and they asked the Vietnamese, who helped you work through the normalized relation process? Because just after that Senate Select Committee, Vietnam got normalized relations with the U.S. Hey, the trade embargo was lifted. They got normalized relations. North Korea, Kim Il-sung at the time, was losing all his monetary backing from Russia, this collapse of the Soviet Union. He was in dire economic need. He was suffering a famine. They had some catastrophe with some tidal waves and flooding and wiped out 50% of their food. He was interested in exploring relations with the U.S. because he knew he had no choice. They went to the Vietnamese. They asked them who, I guess the U.N. embassy to Vietnam was contacted by the North Korean U.N. mission. Who helped you walk through that normalized relation process? How did you do it? And the Vietnamese recommended me. They had called me. They said the DPRK is interested in developing a relationship with you to act as a conduit as you acted with us. Would you be interested? I said I wasn't sure. I made a call to John McCreary, who was a Defense Intelligence Agency analyst, very high-ranking member of the Pentagon. He was also somebody that I worked closely with in the 1992 Senate Select Committee, POW Committee. He was an investigator for that committee. and also legal counsel. John was moved over, coincidentally, to the North Korean desk after that committee. So he was, you know, he had a short staff. He was in charge of intelligence on North Korea. And he had said to me, oh, my God, they must be desperate. The DPRK is North Korea. I wasn't really sure where the DPRK was from. He said, that's North Korea. And, oh, my God, for them to call you, they must be desperate. And when he had said that, some people might take it as an insult. I look at it as an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because desperate people do desperate things.
Kurt, you were starting to say something before, and I went in a different direction. What was it?
No,
you
actually,
wanted to...
yeah, it's very related to this. I was going to say that you know the North Koreans were so isolated at that point, and still are, that they really didn't have a lot of avenues to reach out to the U.S. government when they wanted to change their relations a little bit. And it was, and as Bobby says, you know, it really was a sign of how desperate they were that they ended up getting in touch with a restaurant owner from New Jersey. And I think that you know, it's pretty obvious by now that when they had started hanging out with Bobby, they thought he was a government agent because who else would, other than an intelligence agent, would start spending all of his time with them? And a funny thing happened, which was that as soon as Bobby started spending time with the North Korean officials, inviting them over to his restaurant, taking them out to football games, et cetera, the FBI came around and said, you know, we need you to provide intelligence on what they're saying and what they're asking you to do and, you know, why you're meeting with them. And suddenly Bobby became the thing that the North Koreans thought he was, which is a U.S. intelligence agent. And he became this sort of conduit of information both ways. And Bobby, I found it really interesting that you know, you were open about your relations. You told the North Koreans you were talking to the FBI and the Justice Department and therefore working for the president, as you say. And you told the FBI that you were telling the North Koreans this. And so it was sort of this open channel that the spies of the FBI, were, the counterintelligence people, weren't really comfortable with, but Bobby was, at that point, their only source of information.
Well, it didn't need to be that way because, you know, all the fishing trips and the hunting trips, and they'd have certain delegations that came over here that were high-level delegations to negotiate the disarmament of the nuclear program. And the FBI would give me a whole list of questions that they would want me to ask the delegation leader, and I would say, hey, man, I'm just taking them fishing tomorrow. I don't want to sit here and ask him all these questions. And I would tell my contact and my handler at the FBI, why don't you come with us? They're willing to have you come along. And he would say, what, do you tell them that you're in touch with us? I said, of course I do. I said, come along with us and you can ask them the question. Why doesn't the FBI develop this relationship? For my own purposes, I have this relationship. I have a relationship. It's interesting to me. It's certainly going to serve my country. But it's also going to help me try to get back POWs from North Korea. Because at the time I went from Vietnam to North Korea, North Korea kept POWs at the end of the Korean War. We lost men during the Cold War, and I knew that North Korea had information on these guys. But in the meantime, I'm forced to be this conduit to the U.S. And I don't mind being the conduit where I introduce people, get people together, and let them form their own dialogue, because Bobby Egan had his own agenda. The FBI said they were prohibited. They couldn't. I said, how can you not? You're an intelligence agent. I'm going to develop a contact with in the only black hole of U.S. intelligence. You're going to have an opportunity to fish with the guy and talk with the guy. How could you say no to that? And I can never understand that about our intelligence agencies, how restricted they were, I guess, by the Congress and Senate and our own stupid laws, okay, that they couldn't develop these contacts themselves. They had to use a guy that flipped burgers for a living to do it. I used to tell them, like, when you play telephone when you're a kid, one person says something and the other person says something. By the time it gets around the circle, it's completely different than when you the first person said it. And it's the same thing. I said, you don't need me to ask them and to interpret what they're going to say and then relay it back to you. Okay, you can ask them yourself. I'll develop it where I'll introduce you to them, and you can develop your own relationship. But that's when I became suspect on what the intentions of my government was. They had no intentions to develop a meaningful relationship with North Korea because we had this opportunity all along. There were these high-level contacts, and there were these people that I still consider friends of mine in the North Korean hierarchy that were nuclear negotiators, that were certainly up to the foreign ministry level. I met several generals in North Korea. These are the people that this government had the opportunity to develop relationships with, and they turned their back on it. I was always under the impression early on that they were restricted because of our laws. And then I came to understand that they just didn't want to develop these relationships with North Korea.
The book is Eating with the Enemy, How I Waged Peace with North Korea, from my barbecue shack in Hackensack, written by Robert Egan and Kurt Pitzer, published by St. Martin's Press. That is the book under discussion this hour. Let us know what you think. You have a question for either one of our guests about the things that happened? I mean, there are some great stories, and I'm hoping we'll get to quite a few of them before we get done here this morning. But I'm thinking you probably have some questions for our guests at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. The address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Or you can leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page, and we'll share that with the listening audience as well. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 10:23, almost 10:24. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. Coming up later on the Ideas Network, after 3 on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders with Gene Faraca, a conversation with poet Nick Lance about his new book, which is both meditative and piercingly political. Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, after 3 o'clock today, here on the Ideas Network of WPR. This hour, we're talking about the book Eating with the Enemy, How I Waged Peace with North Korea for My Barbecue Shack in Hackensack by Robert Egan and Kurt Pitzer. Bobby Egan, you were in a kind of a tough position. You were taking a lot of heat from various people for the things that you were trying to do, which, from your point of view, what you were doing made perfect sense, and you were having some results, but you were taking a lot of heat from various people over this.
Yeah, well, from time to time, sure, there's a lot of different intelligence agencies, you know, that are in the mix, and certainly you have your State Department, you know, which, you know, forms are in, I guess, sets out the implement the president's policy on that certain country. You know, so they have to follow certain protocols. And I didn't agree with them at all times, but I was the guy with the relationship. That's how I looked at it. You know, I was the guy that had the influence over the North Koreans. You know, they trusted me. You know, I guided them through, you know, several crises. Certainly, I was the one that had the access to North Korea. Everybody can, talk about North Korea and Washington, but the guy that had the key to the city was me. And when they needed me to go over there, I went. And when they needed to contact certain North Korean officials and bring them to the negotiation table, whether it was because of the nuclear issue, humanitarian issues, political issues, I was the guy that did it. So certainly, I had my opinions. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm not a guy that's going to, you know, act as a servant, not have my own opinions. And at the time, the FBI would say, what's this, the Bobby Egan doctrine? And I would say, what's wrong with that? I've got ideas. I've got opinions on things. Maybe you ought to listen to a few of them. They're practical. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a businessman. You know, we can make this thing work between North Korea and the United States. And certainly, we gave it a go of it. You know, from time to time, there was discussions on North Korea selling its nuclear weapons to the U.S. I was involved in that. Kurt and I discussed it in the book. We had a 20-year plan for the U.S. to buy North Korea's nuclear program, and it would have cost us less money per year than the men that we have on the DMZ today, you know, for the last 60 years or 50 years, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Bobby could have been... We should be clear, could have been prosecuted pretty easily on a couple of U.S. standing laws, including the Trading with the Enemy Act and the Logan Act, which was written specifically to prevent U.S. citizens from conducting U.S. foreign policy on their own. but at the end of the day, I think the government found that it would be a little embarrassing to have a trial and have it come out that they're only lying into North Korea for many years. was a barbecue restaurant owner. You know, and the details that they were getting their information from him might not have been, you know, reflected so well on their government.
Well, I mean, there is a certain logic to having a consistent foreign policy that's that, you know, is something that is directed from one place. And so, you know, I guess I can kind of see where they would have been a little tight around the eyes. But it also seems like, you know, you ought to go with what works.
Well, you know, what's a consistent negative foreign policy, a consistent foreign policy that just isn't working? Hey, you know, I was on the right side of the line when it came to Vietnam. In spite of the fact I felt Vietnam was holding American POWs, the fact that they were absolutely withholding information on men that were left behind, we certainly all know that. I mean, I brought a Vietnamese official out to testify to that openly. I was on that same side of the line. I thought Vietnam should be brought along, and whatever the government wanted to do at the time, I thought was a good idea, and I worked through those issues. I worked through those issues with the families and the people that were against it, and I was an advocate of our government's policies towards normalizing relationships. When I see a bad policy that's not working, and that's costing us taxpayers billions of dollars, and I see another alternative, and I'm the guy, okay, that the government has in place to see this, okay, because certainly the U.S. government kept me there. I mean, I'm an operative. I was an operative for the Squad I-28 counterintelligence of the FBI. I'm reporting to the White House. So certainly the government, if they wanted to remove me from that situation, they could have. We know how quickly the U.S. government can shut you down. But if I see something that's wrong, and if I have an obligation, okay, to go in a different direction, if it's not for the best interest of the United States. I mean, it's a consistently bad policy that we've had on North Korea for many, many years, and it's costing this nation of ours a ton of money. I'm obligated to speak out. There's no reason we can't have normalized relations with that country. Send an embassy staff of 20 people. Let an ambassador develop relationships in Pyongyang. Send a full ambassador over here to Washington so we can work these issues out.
We have
when problems come up, we have a mechanism and relationships in place, not just a relationship that North Korea is dependent on with the guy that flips burgers for a living, but a guy that's trained, a guy that's schooled, a guy that is working in Washington, that has a full staff that can deal with these nuclear issues, economic issues, humanitarian issues.
We have callers on the line who want to join, and I want to make sure we get to them because what generally happens is we end up trying to jam them all into the last 10 minutes. Sue in Richland Center, we'll start with you. Sue, good morning.
Good morning, and Bobby, thank you very much for the book, and I'm really enjoying your program. I'm wondering, did you ever worry about, or maybe still have a worry about, becoming strong-armed by the FBI or the government to do things that really aren't the sole purpose and the goals that you're going after, and maybe getting manipulated in such a way that it's really not going to give you the favorable outcome you're looking for?
Oh, no. You know, the FBI knows I'm a loose cannon. You know, certainly I have a good standing relationship with many agents, but certainly they know that I'm the last guy in the world that they want to strong arm. You know, certainly there's been threats, and there's been, you know, when the book came out, they'd rather not have me do it. They didn't want to release my file. They only released two or 300 pages of my file. Most of it was still blacked out, classified. They voiced their dissatisfaction, but they know that, you know, to put any type of pressure on me or force me to do anything, I'm the wrong guy. You know, I have a lot of contacts in the media. I'm a stand-up guy, and I've had physical confrontations with FBI agents before when we had disagreements over things. You know, so I'm not afraid to roll my sleeves up and, knock around with them a little bit.
Kurt Pitzer, what about you? Have you had any, has there been any fallout for you from being the co-author of this book?
No, other than, you know, I've endeavored not to get in between Bobby and his sort of loose fists and the FBI or any of those guys and their, you know, rough and tumble ways. I'm fine.
Okay.
You know, it's funny, to go back to that question. When part of my files was released, you know, at the time I'm working with the counterintelligence agency, the Freedom of Information Act by, I believe it was the New York Times or Vanity Fair, part of my file was released, and it said Robert Egan is armed and dangerous. And now, you know, and it's funny because the FBI knows I may be armed, but I'm certainly not dangerous. You know, if I'm gonna have a confrontation with them, it might be a push and match or, you know, a little fist cuffs like we had in New York when they were trying to pick up Lake Rankai. They didn't want me. He was a defector from Vietnam. They didn't want me to deliver him to the U.S. Senate Select Committee. They wanted Kai to start spying and not defect and go back to Hanoi. And I was in disagreement with it. I didn't want Kai to risk himself that way, and I wanted him to testify about POWs. So being an FBI agent, had a little fist fight over on Broadway in New York. But other than that, you know, I'm not intimidated by them. And there's certainly a lot of good agents. I have a lot of trust and a lot of faith in the FBI that they wouldn't strong-arm me.
I think the question was very interesting, too, because, the FBI and the U.S. government was put in a very tough position because Bobby's willing to go and talk to anybody about what he's doing, including the media. And so, really, the more pressure that they might try to put on, the sillier they're going to look. They really did hesitate to put on any tactics, strong-arm tactics.
And, you know, a method to my madness was that over the years, I aligned myself with, you know, the media. You know, certainly we've had a good relationship. I don't run to them when I'm in an operative mode, but I have a good relationship with the New York Times, good relationship with Vanity Fair, the New Yorker. So the government knew that I had these, in a phone call, I can call any major publication and give them very credible information on North Korea or Vietnam. And the government knew that's one of the tools that I used to neutralize them, not to harass me.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Culver, Minnesota, and talk to Robert next. Robert, good morning.
Good morning, guys. Beautiful program you've got going on, especially our guest. My point is, I guess it takes us Roberts to do maddening things for the U.S. government. Why don't they pull their head out and work with you on this situation is my question. Second statement here is, can I go on National Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Radio, my heroes, to get details of this program whereby I, too, can join you, Bobby, in your quest to get these people together. I hate war so badly. After my 22 years in the military, I am retired, and I just hate it with a passion, and I want to see our people pulled out of every nation in the world and allow the rest of the world to help out or do their thing and bring our troops home and rebuild our guns and ammunition to protect America. Right now, people almost could walk into this country and have it. But go on with your work and post on websites or wherever you can where we Americans can get on to help your cause out. Okay?
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate that support. And you know something? You know, I'm in agreement. Look, if we have to deploy troops overseas, I'm all for that. You know, certainly I'd rather take the fight to them than have it here. But we don't need to make any more enemies than what we already have. Certainly we can have our differences, and we could disagree with political systems of other countries. But is it necessary then to make them an enemy state? It seems that if we have a political difference with a country, they're not a democracy, they may be a dictatorship, that we have to automatically make them an enemy of the United States. And I don't think that's necessary. We can have our differences and say, you know something, that's not the system for us. It's not the system we chose. Okay, but you could still be our friend. Or we can align and have a relationship that'll serve both peoples better than if we were enemies.
Mm-hmm.
We can have our disagreements and we can live differently. Certainly everybody doesn't have to live like we live. Okay, and if they do live differently, we don't have to recognize them as an enemy state. We can have a relationship with them. We could trade with them, such as we're doing with China right now.
Kurt?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's another thing I found inspiring about your story, Bobby, is that it just took a guy with because face it, coming from a mobbed up background with a bit of street wisdom of keep your friends close and your enemies closer, to bring that as a single individual to U.S. foreign policy. You know, as your caller points out, most of us listen to the radio and we feel outraged by this or that. And we, you know, some of us donate to an organization or we vote a certain way or the other. But, you know, none of us have ever taken it as far as Bobby and gone out and tried to befriend a foreign government and really change things. And I think it calls into question, you know, what are each of us doing?
And Bobby, you've worked on this issue during the time of several different presidents. Compare, say, for example, working with the government under the Clinton administration as opposed to, say, the second President Bush and President Obama. What have been some of the different challenges you faced, or has it been pretty much the same?
Slick Willie was the best. Bill Clinton was number one. You know, something I had the least resistance. We had a lot of disagreements, but certainly my participation level was more welcomed under the Clinton administration than any other administration. The Bush administration, you know, the Bush administration tried to shut us down. You know, they didn't want me to have any type of dialogue with North Korea. And in fact, he shut North Korea out of all kinds of any type of meaningful dialogue with the U.S. for over 2 years. And then I had the North Koreans. I took Phil Sheehan from the New York Times, in first Western reporter ever to go into the North Korean embassy, and we did a full-page interview that, in 2002, I believe, November, was put on the front page of the Time on Sunday with Ambassador Han, okay, declaring that North Korea wants to talk to the U.S., that and it will openly negotiate its nuclear weapons and its nuclear weapon program. That's what it took to wake Bush up. But Bush, it was word was sent to me. I was fired as an operative for Squad I-28 under the Bush administration, that the FBI was to have no more dialogue with me, and that I was to stop all kinds of relations with the North Koreans, which I did. And I told the Bush administration that, well, if I'm not advising you guys anymore, I'll start advising them. And I stayed very close to the UN mission through those tense times. And I worked with the North Koreans on, you know, many issues. And what I did more importantly, and we can't lose sight of this, was I had the opportunity, too, to show the North Koreans what America was about. And I took them all over this country. And they got to meet everyday normal Americans, from state assemblymen to restaurant owners to roofers, you know, certainly to my next-door neighbors, to people at Cubby's restaurant. I mean, it was once, twice a week the North Koreans were in my restaurant. They had an opportunity to meet all kinds of people. We went fishing, hunting. They met fishing boat captains. They met guys at local hunting clubs. They had the opportunity to see what we were all about, because they, too, were led astray through all the propaganda and the Cold War rhetoric about what we were about. They thought we were bearded wolves. And I showed them it wasn't true. So the impact that I had on the North Koreans was they had the opportunity to see what the average American was all about. They stayed at Jane Fallon's home during the 1996 Olympics. Her husband was missing in Laos. Certainly they had an opportunity to be hosted during the 1996 Olympics by a family that suffered the tragic fate of having, you know, someone come up missing in a war. They had the opportunity to meet all her neighbors. They spent 3 weeks with her. And so they had the opportunity, you know, North Korea had the opportunity to get an idea what this nation was about. And in conclusion, they decided that they needed and they wanted desperately normalized relations with this government. They seen that we were worth it. Before that, they were unsure. They didn't know what we were about. They knew less about us than we knew about them.
When we come back, Bobby, I want you to talk about your visit to North Korea and what happened to you over there I know there was an incident where you allowed yourself to have truth serum administered so you could be interviewed. I want you to tell that story and about your relationship with Ambassador Han, because those are a couple of things that really stood out for me in this book. We're talking about the book Eating with the Enemy by Robert Egan and Kurt Pitzer. Wondering what you think. 800-642-1234. Lines available right now if you call. 800-642-1234. The email address, talk@WPR.org. You can also post a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page, and we'll share it here. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 10:43. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Coming up next, Larry Mueller is in to talk about Wisconsin wildlife with UW-Madison and Extension Professor of Wildlife Ecology Scott Craven. That's coming up next here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the book Eating with the Enemy, How I Waged Peace with North Korea from my barbecue shack in Hackensack. Robert Egan and Kurt Pitzer, the co-authors of that book, with us. Before the break, Bobby, I said I wanted you to talk about your experience in North Korea with Truth Serum. You went over there, 1994, and you had an interesting interview.
What happened was I developed a few-month relationship. The start of my relationship was developed here at the UN when Ambassador Ho-Jung and at the time Consulate Han decided that they wanted to take this relationship further, but I'd have to go over there and get checked out by the boys in North Korea. And I agree to it, you know, similar to like a mafia sit-down. Somebody brings you in for initiation. They want to make you a made guy. Well, then you got to go to the meeting, meet the boss and the underboss and everybody else, and then they ultimately will make the decision. So it was the in Pyongyang, it was the central government there that would make the decision whether Ho-Jung and Han and the UN mission here went further with me and at what capacity. So it was important that I go over there, and this is what Han said to me. And I decided not to go alone because I heard so many, you know, so many mysterious things about North Korea. I was privileged because I was working at the time with the different intelligence agencies, and there was just so many warnings that they were giving me, that they had these programs of kidnapping foreigners, that people go in and they never come out, that Kim Jong-il, his father had died, but they had these programs of holding hostages and holding people indefinitely, and it'd really be nothing we can do if you got, you know, they decided to, you know, keep you. So what I decided to do, I developed a relationship with the New York Giants and decided to bring the Giants chaplain. The first time I took the North Koreans out publicly, and this was before I went to North Korea, we took them to a New Jersey Net game, and the Giants were their hosts. By taking the New York Giants chaplain with me, I knew then that it would be much harder for the North Koreans to keep me because of the exposure that the press would give it, because this guy's the chaplain from the New York Giants. You know, the NFL would get on their case. You know, if I went over alone and they kept me, I don't think I'd make the back page of the local paper. So I ended up going over there with Dave Bratton, very courageous, at the time, courageous minister for the chaplain. He had overseas experience because he worked with Camps Crusades for Christ, and he worked in communist Poland when he started his ministry. So when we had flew in, I tell you one thing, it was a place like, you know, and at the time, I'm pretty seasoned because I've been traveling back and forth to Southeast Asia alone. I was spending, you know, a lot of time in Hanoi before the embargo was lifted, before there was any Americans that, you know, would have that type of access to communist Vietnam as I did just after the war. But I'll tell you one thing. I flew into North Korea. It was like going into a different world. It even smelled different. I mean, it was a 28 million people country. They followed Kim Il-sung. He had just passed away. Kim Jong-il was on the rise. And it was certainly like, the Jim Jones cult down in Guyana. 28 million people following blindly one guy. Scary place. The birds didn't even sing there. And it was funny afterwards. When I came back, I said, you know, it was funny. I didn't even the squirrels and the birds are scared. I don't see any of those. And the guys over the Pentagon said, that's because they're in the middle of a famine and they've probably all been eaten. You know, at that point, they were eating the bark on the trees. You know, that's how the place is very orderly. I mean, certainly there wasn't any crime. Pyongyang that's where I had gone into the capital of North Korea, and that's a model city.
So what did they want to know from you?
That's where just the elite of the North Korean hierarchy live. I believe there's a million or 2 million people in Pyongyang. It's just the most loyal people of North Korea live in that city. There's a barrier, a fence, and checkpoints around the whole city. So even the other people from North Korea can't get into Pyongyang. And that's where we got into.
What was it that they wanted to know from you?
Well, I guess they wanted to know what my intentions were. Certainly they knew that I was involved with the defection of a top-ranking or a mid-ranking Vietnamese government official. Defections are a no-no in Vietnam, but it's a capital crime there. But certainly the consequence in North Korea is much higher, because if there's a defection, they'll kill three generations on down. Okay, so one guy defects, they'll take three generations of that family and execute them. So, you know, they knew that was in my background, that I double-crossed Vietnam, but I did that for our POWs. I did that to shed light on the fact that Vietnam was holding American POWs. And the North Koreans knew that. But they needed to know that any of those tactics I wouldn't use, that I'd be loyal to them, that they certainly wanted me to be loyal to my country. The conditions of this relationship is that I was going to be an honest conduit between both governments. That was very important with them, that I didn't get involved in any dirty dealings with any North Korean officials, trying to earn any dirty cash, that I'd stay pure, stay out of trouble, act as a conduit between both governments, stay loyal to both governments. And I agreed to that. Certainly, they wanted to put me under. I guess, at face value, they wanted to see that if I was willing to submit to an interrogation, and I openly did it. You know, they shot me up with, I guess it was sodium pentothal, the truth serum. I had a minor reaction from it. Sinuses bothered me for several weeks after. But I willingly submitted to it, and my opinion right now is certainly better than getting waterboarded, right?
Well, I would think so.
I'll take that any day over getting dunked 80 times.
I would imagine.
But, and through that, they seen that I had a willingness to, submit to them, which is important to a communist regime, that they seen that I would submit to them, I had nothing to hide, that I understood what the conditions of the relationship were to move forward. And, something between you and I, that I had a set of you-know-what. They wanted somebody, there's a lot of bad things that happen in North Korea. Certainly, I don't agree with their system. I don't agree with their human rights violations. There's a lot of dirty, nasty things that I've seen. I don't think we have to discuss those. But they needed somebody that had a big enough set of you-know-what that he would be able to, put up with this. He would certainly be able to see this and still not hold judgment on them. To still be effective, to still have an open mind, and be willing to go forward with them.
Kurt Pitzer, I want to ask you before we run out of time here, as you were covering this, and you covered it as a story, you're the co-author of the book, what was the most interesting aspect of this whole thing for you?
Wow, well, there are many. And I think, part of it is that beneath all of the really sort of important lessons of the book, that you can take away about how we treat other cultures, how we make enemies and maybe shouldn't, there's a lot of humor to this story. I mean, there are some really, truly funny parts of the book throughout. I mean, Bobby had Ambassador Han, the ambassador from North Korea, taken to a mobster dentist to have a tooth pulled, and they put him under general anesthesia for 4 hours with the FBI freaking out that, what happens if a North Korean ambassador who's not used to U.S. pharmaceuticals pass away in a dentist chair in New Jersey? Look at how the First World War got started. Things could go pretty haywire. And they're just sort of crazy adventures throughout that really push the boundaries of what you would expect between two countries. And so that's part of what I found really remarkable, is that they're just outlandish adventures. And the telling of the book was just fun for that. And I think it's a really fun read.
Kurt, how I handled that was that If any of our friends had a toothache, right, guys, what are we going to do? We're going to bring them to the dentist. So Han's my friend. So my logic is, why wouldn't I bring him to the dentist? Because 1 out of 100,000 people die in the chair? I told the FBI that. I mean, if somebody has a toothache, the logical thing to do is bring him to a dentist. Okay, there's not a second option here. We bring him to the dentist. Okay, we get him treated. And that's what we do with friends. So why should I treat Han any different than anybody else? Because he's a North Korean? I says, no, that doesn't cut it with me. And that was my logic throughout the relationship that I had with them, and I think that's why my relationship went as far as it did, because it was practical. I did the practical thing. I didn't treat them any differently than I would treat anybody else. And I think that's what the North Koreans appreciated in me and the people that I brought to them.
We have another caller who wants to join us. Mike in Stevens Point is on the line. Mike, good morning. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, hey. For one thing, I was at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service from 67 to 71, and I was from Stevens Point. You know, I thought all the countries should be able to get along better, and so I kind of specialized in the Soviet Union at the time, and we went to the Soviet embassy, and they came to our school, and we spoke in Russian and everything. And I became interested in the world in general, and the Vietnam War, of course, was going on at the time, but it was related to the Korean War. It hadn't been over for that long. But anyway, so I became involved in politics in general, and I worked with a group, and we had a conference in New York City, and our organization regularly, like this fellow from New Jersey, we regularly contacted people from DPRK's embassy, and they came by, and we went to common meetings together, and I found the people conversed about just about anything that they wanted to, and we even went out to bars and had drinks together, and we even went to people's apartments and had a little bit of cannabis. And but one thing people don't realize is, you know, at the end of the Korean War, now Japan has a population of 11% Koreans are a minority, much like the population of African Americans in the United States. And 90% of the people in Japan send their remittances to the DPRK, and their organizations are very closely watched by the Japanese government. And if the government of the DPRK was so horrible, and these people have the opportunity to live in Japan and converse with either the DPRK or the Republic of Korea, South Korea, you know, I find it unusual that they would, you know, correspond with the people in the North. And it may have something to do with the fact that when Japan, with the collusion of the United States from 1905 to 1945, the Korean people were not allowed to even speak the Korean language.
But, and Mike, we're running out of time, and I've got a couple of things I need our guests to address here before we get done, and we're really running short on time. Bobby, I understand that you have you've posted your famous barbecue sauce recipe online, and I think we're going to have a link to that on the WPR page and on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page. Why did you do that?
Well, I thought it was a good idea. You know, certainly it was the Koreans' favorite sauce. So I figured the two tied in, and, you know, it was all about cooking. You know, a lot of what the North Koreans and I did was eat together. And certainly they come from an impoverished nation, and the budget here at the UN was, you know, very, very limited. They had to be creative on their own. And we hung our hat at the restaurant, and we chowed down on barbecue for the last 14, 15 years. And I thought it would be nice for, you know, people to have the recipe. It was Kurt's idea. So we put it there online.
Well, I looked at it, and it looks pretty tasty. Reminds me, it looked pretty close to the one my mother makes. So,
well, I'll take that as a compliment then.
Yeah, well, she
anything
makes
that mom
good
makes is good.
Hey, there you go. You got to go with mom. Well, listen, you know, any interest? Has there been any interest shown in turning parts of this or all of this book into a film? This looks like this has got Hollywood written all over it.
Well, you know, That's Kurt's job.
We'll see.
I leave that up to Kurt. That's his.
Kurt, what do you think? Are you getting any nibbles?
Well, we have lots of interest, and so it's a process that's happening now. So stay tuned.
Okay. Well, we'll watch. We'll watch for that. Thank you both so much for a very interesting hour. What a fascinating story this is, and a great topic. Bobby Egan, Kurt Pitzer, you're very welcome. Enjoy the fishing. Bobby Egan, Kurt Pitzer, co-authors of Eating with the Enemy, How I Waged Peace with North Korea from my barbecue shack in Hackensack, published by St. Martin's Press. And as I said, that barbecue recipe is online, and links to it exist on the WPR.org page or website and on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page as well. Thanks to a whole bunch of people for making this possible here this morning. I really appreciate the help of Rhonda Fanning and Dave Potras and Chrissy Pease and everybody else for helping out. If you want to listen to the program, if you missed a part of it, you can go to the WPR.org page, go to the Kathleen Dunn portion of that website and listen to it all over again. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR.